Theseus nuzzles my neck, his hand dipping lower. Help me in the maze, Ariadne. Please. What if I did help him? If I gave him my thread? If I told him the secrets of the maze? Then I would be responsible for the death of my brother. Somewhere, Sigmund Freud's head is just spinning.
I love you.
Hey there, people. Welcome back to the Great YA Quest. I'm your host, Renee M.P.T. Cray, and we are on episode 4 of our search for a 5-star young adult fiction. Now at this point, we've learned a lot about YA, such as anger problems in dudes are hot. If a guy is deeply sensitive, he will definitely space out and or lie about himself. Girls who are unsure of themselves will be able to find who they were meant to be with the help of the hot guy. And when in doubt about how to solve world problems or save lives, base all decisions and actions around the hot guy and you won't go wrong, because he will transform you into a woman. And these beautiful gems of lessons from the YA world, they transcend space and time and location and genre and guys whose names are all weird but somehow sound the same, and all the different earth and food-based scents of said guys. But today, we're just going to focus on the time aspect, because our read for today is The Lifestyles of Gods and Monsters by Emily Robertson. And this book messes with all the rules of time, so I hope you're prepared. We'll start with the cover, which, you'll be proud of me, for once was not the reason why I bought this book. It is a black cover featuring a statue that looks kind of like a typical ancient marble statue. Girl in a long dress, seated, but she's holding a smartphone in her hand. The title is in flowy white font, and there's a neon pink outline around it, and at the very top is the book's tagline, which is, "Royalty sells, romance sells, death sells," which weirdly tells us absolutely nothing about the book, but at the same time sums it up pretty thoroughly. So there's that. I do like that once you kind of know what the book is about, you can look at the image on the cover and it pretty much sums up exactly what this setting is. But it is a little bit simple for my taste. It kind of looks like something that could have been like put together in Microsoft Paint. So I've seen this cover before, and I've actually walked past this book a lot of times. I was only compelled to pick it up because I was in Barnes & Noble one day and I had store credit that was only good to the end of that day, so I was just kind of like looking around at everything. And then when I found out that it was a retelling of a Greek myth, that was what actually made me interested. Greek myths, they've always been very important stories to me. Like, one of the first books that I can remember really, really loving was this little, like, Dover Classics paperback of famous Greek myths, and it has, you know, Heracles fighting the Hydra on the cover. And I would take this book and, like, hide away from chores to read it instead. I've just always loved Greek mythology. It's one of the most interesting types of story. And I find it so cool that these stories have continued through time just so long, even though no one really believes in this religious system anymore. But the stories are so, so well known. So when I finally picked this book up and took a look at it and realized that this is a retelling of a Greek myth, I knew I had to read it. So going into it, my expectation was really just Greek myth retelling. How's it gonna go? Will it be interesting? I guess if I could say anything, I expected maybe an adventure type story, because most Greek myths do tend to have, you know, epic adventure and very little character development. So I hoped that I could have a focus on an adventure this time. So now that we understand why I decided to take this particular plunge, let's talk about the characters that we will be plunging with. Now, in the initial myth, we really only have three main characters. We have Theseus, Prince of Athens, who is the hero of the story, Ariadne, Princess of Crete, who helps Theseus escape, and then we have our villain, which is, in this case, the Minotaur. He is half bull, half man, and he is a carnivore. He will eat people. So that's really all that we had in the original. And all three of those characters are here in an updated way, but we do have a couple of other new characters, or, you know, expanded upon characters. So we'll talk about those a little bit too. In the myth, Theseus is the main character. Of course, it's always a young guy, you know, hero's journey, setting off on these quests. But in this book, we have a switch to focus on Ariadne. Now, just as in the myth, Ariadne is a princess of Crete. So her father is the king of Crete. Ariadne here is the only one who can safely navigate the labyrinth of the Minotaur. In the myth, Theseus asks her for help, and she shows him that the way to kind of beat the labyrinth is to tie a piece of string to the door and kind of spool it along behind you as you go so that you can follow your way back out once you've killed the Minotaur, which is kind of a duh moment. But, you know, Greek princes are never known for their brains, except for Odysseus. Here, she still has the ball of string, only it's been updated to be a ball of wire. And when she attaches it to certain walls in the labyrinth, it turns off traps that are set up there and allows her to pass by unharmed. So that's been given a pretty serious upgrade. Now, in this world, the labyrinth is a reality TV show that Ariadne and her family host. So Ariadne is the youngest daughter of this very rich, very powerful, very, very famous family. That includes her mom, who is most well known for having sex with the Cretan bull. Yeah, they included that in the part of the myth. Her dad, who insists that the gods want them to do the Labyrinth TV show because it avenges his son, Ariadne's older brother, who was unfairly killed in Athens years ago. And her two older sisters, who have a show called The Paradoxes, and who are only really known for their sex appeal and their huge asses. The photographers yell, "Turn around, girls, turn around!" Obediently, my sisters spin and wiggle. The camera zooms in, blowing up their tushes, larger than life. In the next frame, my mother glows with maternal pride. Tushies sell. Now that we all know that tushies sell, if this isn't a little dig at the Kardashians, I kind of don't know what is. So that's her sisters. Now, Ariadne, of course, like every YA girl, is different from them. She's just different. She dresses in black and is, you know, doesn't want to be seen. And although she is in this world that they're in, she hates it. But of course, she also, like every other YA girl, does nothing to make a difference. She just sits there hating everyone and playing video games. I prop myself up on the idiotic throw pillows my mother insists on installing on my bed, then put on my VR headset. Finally, now I can get back to playing First Blood. I'm hoping the game will make me not think about that boy, Theseus, the gods be cursed Prince of Athens. The first boy who has ever looked at me with interest would turn out to be from our greatest enemy. There is not one thing in my life that can be easier. The techno music from the party my mother and sisters are throwing for our guests and the media is loud enough that I can hear it over the game's audio, even with my headset on. I turn up the volume. I need to concentrate. The next boss is a pain. That's our Ariadne. Her hobbies consist of video games, Video games. She plays them by herself. She sometimes plays them in her pajamas. She sometimes plays them in only her underwear, which I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm old and therefore I am always cold, but I've never had the urge to, like, strip down to play a game. Like, I've never been like, oh yeah, the Sims are on my screen, gotta strip down, you know? Hey, it's time for Animal Crossing, get these vegetables off my hands and these pants off my ass, you know? But I also don't play a lot of video games, so maybe this is some secret code that I just don't understand. But there you go, there's Ariadne. When she's not complaining about her sisters, she's playing video games by herself. That is literally all she does. An updated character for this version of the story that we get is Icarus. Now, although Icarus would have been present in the original myth, he's really not mentioned, right? His father is the one who designed the labyrinth for the Minotaur, but Icarus himself never really came in to the myth of the Minotaur. He's most well known for, of course, the myth Icarus and the Sun, in which his dad, after the Minotaur is defeated... Spoiler alert for anyone who doesn't know Greek myth, I guess. But after the Minotaur is defeated, his dad is imprisoned in the labyrinth along with Icarus. So the dad makes wings out of feathers and wax for him and his son to fly away. And of course, as we all know, Icarus flies too close to the sun. The wax melts off of his wings and he falls to his death in the ocean. So that's where we primarily know Icarus from. In this version, he is Ariadne's gay best friend who has just been promoted to be the producer of the Labyrinth contest. Now, I can't really figure out why these two are friends, except that they're close-ish in age, because Icarus seems to be very ambitious, and Ariadne, I mean, we've already heard about her ambitions. Icarus is young, only 19, the same age as Akael. But he's been working on our shows since elementary school. He took over producing The Paradoxes 2 years ago, and he just started as showrunner for the Labyrinth contest because his dad wanted to go back to making inventions. Because Icarus is my best friend, I can tell he's nervous about this meeting, his first with Daddy since he became the showrunner, but I'm not sure anyone else can see it. The main role that Icarus plays in this is he does actually produce the show and provide that kind of technical talk about what's going on with that, but also he pushes Ariadne to do something different, to just try new things, even if sometimes the things he's pushing her to try are not the best. At least he's telling her, like, hey, you can't have a life that's just video games. That's not a life. So I appreciated the fact that I was not the only one who was kind of getting fed up with Ariadne just being like, my life sucks, so I'm just gonna stay here and do nothing. So thank you, Icarus, for also wanting Ariadne to get off her keister and do something. We don't actually see Icarus's end. That is not referenced in this book. Like I said, it kind of makes sense because that was a completely separate myth, but it is alluded to. Icarus has like these pictures of himself that he paints wings on, which is meant to represent his ambition, and is, I guess, supposed to be like sad foreshadowing for us, but I kind of thought that it was hilarious, to be totally honest. Maybe that's, again, just because I'm old and grumpy and it's just like, ha, damn teeny boppers. But every time Ariadne's like, oh my gosh, Icarus, he's going to fly straight up to the sun. It's like, yeah, he is. So yeah, Grandma Nene Vicious, I guess. Now, before we move on to the reason why all these YA books exist, the love interest, let's take a brief moment to talk about the Minotaur. He is a creature composed of the body of a man with the head of a bull, and he has the strength of a shit ton of people, right? So it's not like you can just go and be like, I'm just gonna stab this, you know, little nerd guy and he's gonna die. No, it would be like fighting a bull mixed with Arnold Schwarzenegger. You're not gonna do very well at that. He defeats a lot of people. He is the result of Ariadne's mom getting her ba-chicka-wa-wa on with the Cretan bull, which was just a giant white dude cow. In this edition, he's torn between his two natures. The human part of him is struggling to maintain control over the bull aspect of him. He only has contact with Ariadne because everyone else just sees him as a monster. And he speaks to her with sign language because, of course, he can't really speak as a human. I thought that the Minotaur was really well written in this book, and honestly, it was the most interesting thing that this adaptation of the myth brought to the table. You really get a feel for the Minotaur, even though he's the monster that kills everyone, right? And when Ariadne cares for him, because that's her job as, like, keeper of the maze, like I said, she's the only one who can go into the labyrinth, safely at least. So when she goes down and, like, spends time with him and calms him and, you know, puts stuff on his wounds that he's received after fighting everybody, it's honestly the only real time that I cared for Ariadne. It was the only time that she actually did anything. So the Minotaur really brought out the best in her, and he was just a really good version of this classic character. But we all know by now that a YA girl does not survive by companionship of her brother or guy best friend alone. Oh no. No, she needs a smexy, uninterested, probably dangerous boy toy to open her eyes and probably her legs. I think I just need to let you all meet Theseus, Prince of Athens, eventual champion of the labyrinth, and lover of Ariadne, in exactly the same way that I did. Because, to be honest, this is probably the most perfectly YA moment I've ever encountered. Then I spot him in the row behind me. A boy, about my age, looking at me with undisguised interest. His long legs are kicked out in front of him. He is broad across the chest, with curly hair and a nose that has been broken at least once. His eyebrows are dark slashes over bright eyes. He has a suit on, like the other men, but he wears it differently, casually, with the tie loose at his throat, the jacket unbuttoned, his posture relaxed, jiggling his foot like he is full of electrical energy, like he is ready to explode. If I had a type, he would be it. I look back at my screen, collapsing my shoulders and deploying the tricks of invisibility, but he doesn't stop looking at me, his eyes crackling with humor and intelligence. Who is he? He raises an eyebrow at me. I scowl instead. His smile doesn't waver. But here's the thing. It isn't dumb or open-faced, like someone without a thought in his head. It's full of wry humor. Like there's a joke he's waiting for me to pick up on. And he'll take his time. He's inviting me to acknowledge the absurdity of this whole situation. Then I do it. Across the box, looking at someone I've never met before, I giggle. When was the last time I did that? And that's Theseus. He pursues Ariadne relentlessly and stalkerishly from the very beginning. Shortly after this scene, he introduces himself to her and is like, "You're my favorite person that I saw on TV." And she somehow thinks that this leads into true love. So yeah, he just appears everywhere that Ariadne is. And that's Theseus's character. In a nutshell. Creeper. He's basically Akira without the rod. Now, whether that's good or bad, I'll let you decide. So now that we've met the majority of our cast, let's jump right into the plot. In the original myth, we follow Theseus, the newly discovered Prince of Athens, who journeys to Crete to fight the Minotaur. Every year, Athens has been forced to send a sacrifice of 6 boys and 6 girls to put into the labyrinth, and either die there of the elements a la Jack Torrance in The Shining, or more likely, to be eaten by the Minotaur. If the Minotaur can be defeated, then Crete will no longer have a hold over Athens, and Athens can be free. Theseus ends up defeating the Minotaur by using a ball of string given to him by Princess Ariadne, which he uses to track his way back after killing the Minotaur. He then escapes with Ariadne in tow, forgets her on a beach after they camped there overnight, forgets to change the sails of his ship from black to white to let his dad know he's okay, and so arrives back at Athens alone to find out that his dad saw the black sail and killed himself from despair. So now Theseus is the king of Athens. The moral of this myth is clearly, don't forget important shit. Like, write yourself a damn note or something, Theseus, you freak. Now, in this book, the sacrifice to the Minotaur still goes on, but as mentioned, it is updated to a very popular reality TV contest. And remember earlier I said that this book messes with time, and that's kind of what I'm talking about. Like, we still have people talking about the gods, we still have the names of all these ancient kingdoms and places and everything. It's literally the exact same setting as the myth, except that they have all of our modern day technology. There are phones, there's the internet, there's TV. Everything that we have now is just kind of transplanted into the Greek world, the ancient Greek world. And if you are expecting an explanation for that, don't. It's never given. It just is what it is. So although Athens is still forced to send people to Crete to die, because there is a monetary prize offered to whoever can defeat the Minotaur, people actually really want to go in this version. So the best athletes and fighters from all over the world move to Athens to try to be able to earn a spot to go and try their luck against the Minotaur. So our story begins with them all prepping for a new season of the Labyrinth Contest. I believe it was the 12th season or something around there. It's kind of become a staple, but much like American Idol, after a while, people are just not interested anymore. They're talking about how people don't really believe that the Minotaur can be beaten anymore. So they are trying to insert drama to up ratings. It's at the very beginning of all this that Ariadne meets Theseus, and sparks fly right away. We barely make it into this book before that shit starts, right? And so there's the whole scene that I read to you earlier about her meeting Theseus, and I think that's on like page 13. And then later that night, she encounters Theseus again, and this happens. As soon as we step on the elevator car, he will see me, torn, bloodied, and messy. He will be full of questions that I'm not allowed to answer. Without really deciding to do it, I turn toward him. I go up on tiptoe and press my lips to his. They are exactly as soft as I have been imagining. He tastes like he smells. Clean, minty, fresh. So that happens on page 56. We didn't even make it 100 pages without the boy scent happening. And unfortunately, this whole back and forth thing with her just being absurdly attracted to Theseus, even though she doesn't really even know him, that's pretty much all that's going on for like the first 100 pages. I mean, we do have them talking about the setup of the world and they're prepping for the show, but mostly it's just Ariadne being instantly entranced by Theseus's all-encompassing hotness. Finally, all this stupid cat and mouse, but not really, because they've already started kissing right away. It all culminates when these two idiots go for a run, and Theseus finally asks Ariadne for her help in navigating the maze. And he does this by telling her that he is looking for a friend. He grabs my hand, looking at me intently, his eyes dark and serious. I need someone to help me. I'm looking for a friend. I need to understand what is happening here. The unspoken message of his hand holding mine is clear too. He runs his fingers across my knuckles, and the feeling ricochets through my whole body. He wants more than that. I do too. The magnetic pull between us is so strong that I lean in toward him, toward those lips. He's sweaty, but so am I. The cool breeze blows across both of us, carrying away our stench. I think that friend must mean something very different in Athens than it does in the rest of the world, because what? That's how you treat your friend? Theseus, what? Oh my gosh, he's so creepy. So that happens. And then, oh, for good measure, in that same conversation, he also is like, I know I can trust you, and I need you to be my friend, because even though, like, you know, I told you that the only reason I knew who you were was because I saw you on TV, right? You're the only one on this whole place who's real. You're genuine. So I can trust you, which is like, you know, yeah, sure. Go ahead and tell moody teens that by hiding away from their problems and playing video games nonstop in their underwear, that's how you be true to you. That's how you become a genuine person. Yeah, sure. Let's tell that to the teens. Great. Fine. You know, whatever. That's, oh my gosh. It's, yeah. Ultimately, Theseus asks Ariadne for help with the maze, and she refuses because that will culminate in the death of her brother, the Minotaur, whose human side she can still see and interact with. Shortly after this, the competition officially, finally, begins with an opening ceremony, and of course, Theseus is presented as a surprise competitor. Who knew? Theseus joins the competitors on the stage. He calls them into a circle around him. His arms are raised, his voice is deep and resonant. This year, the Minotaur will be sacrificed. This is the year the contest ends. His face is blown up on the Jumbotron. Then he winks. A wink that will launch 1,000 gifts. Oh my goodness, what a shock. Who could have seen this coming when he was asking her for her help in defeating the maze? Who would have guessed that he would end up going in the maze? It's just a shock. Who's gonna randomly touch her hip now? Let's also take a moment to appreciate the fact that I think Theseus is about as good at winking as Rocket is in Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Anyways. After this, Ariadne sneaks off to visit Theseus in his room, as one does. And they talk about what's going to happen, but more importantly, they suck face in a, I've wanted to do that for so long ever since I met you 2 days ago type of way. And it ends with Theseus being convinced that Ariadne is going to help him defeat the maze, but Ariadne actually gives no confirm or deny, like she's not saying anything about it. Then she has to run out to comfort her brother Asterion, aka the Minotaur, because whenever he gets mad, he causes an earthquake. Unfortunately for Ariadne, she has somehow forgotten that there are cameras everywhere. So this whole exchange has been caught on tape. Icarus, her best friend, decides that they are going to turn this blossoming romance into a subplot for this season of the Labyrinth Contest, because, as we pointed out earlier, the Labyrinth Contest has been failing in ratings recently, and they're looking for a way to kind of boost that. Ariadne, of course, rejects this, but she doesn't really get a say in it. The agreed-upon story between Icarus and Ariadne's dad is that Ariadne will lead Theseus on, tell him she'll help him, and then betray him. Oh, and she will have to lose her virginity to him on camera. For the views, of course. So her mom gives her a total makeover and basically turns her into a sex doll, and then the plan is for Ariadne to seduce Theseus on camera, or else she has to face some monumental punishment from her dad. Forbidden love, the keeper of the maze unmasked, the chance the Minotaur will be beaten, our ratings are going to be through the roof. By the time Theseus manages to get in your pants, the whole world is going to be talking about you two. No, I say, shaking my head. He's not getting in my pants. I don't even want him there. Icarus spins and looks at me hard. Don't give me that. I saw your face. You want this as much as he does. Being attracted to someone and wanting to hook up with them on camera are not the same. Don't you know that? Stop, Icarus, just stop. I can't do this. He grins at me, turning on his charm, but I fight it, standing straight as a statue. How could you? I say through gritted teeth. His laugh is brittle. You think I make these decisions? Adorable. Ariadne, I'm not in any position to say no. If you cared so much about your privacy, you shouldn't have gone down there. This is such a boggling aspect to this book, because on one hand, Ariadne is rejecting the objectification that is being forced on her, which feels very real. She has always been able to hide while the rest of her family is being very over-the-top sexual, and now she's being forced to take part in that, and she's, you know, kind of rejecting this objectification of herself into just another hot chick. That is something that, on different levels, women all have to deal with as they grow up. That there will be people, not all people, but some people, who will just always see you as tits in a vagina, no matter what you do, or how hard you work, or how many degrees you earn. But the problem with this is that Ariadne is embarking upon this fight to not be seen in a sexual way, but the whole time we've known her, all she's been doing is getting all hormonal with Theseus. So she's rejecting being sexualized and seen as eye candy for the world, but she wants to be Theseus's eye candy? Why does she have to be eye candy at all, is my question. Like, why? Why does she have to be seen in a sexual light? I think that maybe if she and Theseus were friends and she was being pressured to take it sexual, that would be really cool and a very interesting scenario. But instead, she's saying, I don't want to be a sexual object, when she has been letting this strange guy who she doesn't even know paw her over every chance he gets just because he's hot. So she's already sexualized herself. It doesn't make it okay for her family to want to take it public, but it does make it hard to take her indignity seriously when she only comes alive to drool over Theseus, even though they have literally, they don't even know each other at all. So once she gets all dolled up, Ariadne goes to one of her mother's parties because she has to. And this finally starts opening her eyes, and she sees that maybe, just maybe, her family might be just as unhappy as she is. Shocker. She realizes that her mom is pretty much mentally unstable. She has this whole conversation with her dad in which he tells her that he's been giving her too much freedom and she's a woman so she can't be trusted, which crushes her because she thought her dad was the only one she could trust. And this makes her also look differently at her sisters, who she always judged so harshly. She notices that they are on drugs in order to cope and that maybe they don't like being constantly touched and objectified. Eyes are on me from every direction, in a way that I have never felt before. It's desire, and anger, and possession. Even with my bodyguards, people touch me as I pass them, as though my tight dress gives them permission. My skin crawls. This must be what it is like for my sisters all the time. So we've finally got a little bit of development from Ariadne. But then, of course, she has to go find Theseus and take him off, right? So she does that. She finds Theseus in the party, and she takes him off to this private room that has been set up for the sole purpose of her taking him there and then having sex with him on camera. They actually surprise me with this scene by finally giving us a real conversation between Ariadne and Theseus. Theseus finally opens up a little bit, and he talks about how he had to prove himself physically strong before his dad would even acknowledge him, and about how difficult it is to have to always try to prove yourself as a man. After I was born, my mother wrote to tell King Aegeus that he had a son. That's when he came back to Trozen to hide the sandals and the knife. He told her that if I could move the stone and get them, he would claim me as his son, but only if I was strong enough to do it myself. He wasn't interested in a weak son. He was worried that if I was weak, it would be easy for the Palantides to take over. That's messed up, I say. He shrugs. Says the girl who leads kids to their deaths because her parents make her do it. My parents make me do it because the gods told them to, I say. Sure they do, he says, his voice full of sarcasm. He runs his hands through his hair. You want to know the most screwed up thing? My mom told me that she didn't even like Aegeus. She was only 16. He was over 40. Aegeus was staying at my grandfather's house, and grandfather made my mom take Aegeus out on the beach and get him drunk and seduce him, even though it was her first time. My grandfather sold my mother's innocence for the chance to have a prince in the family. The way he says the word prince makes it sound dirty, like a curse. Not only is it great to finally get some actual development and backstory out of Theseus, but it's also cool that this is happening at the time when they were supposed to be having sex. And it's very cool to see a representation of a different type of intimacy, an emotional intimacy. This was honestly the best scene between these two. And if it had come in earlier in the story, or if they had, you know, taken it slower initially with the hormones, I might have been able to get behind this pairing. But it's so hard to take them seriously when they've just been nibbling each other's necks from the very first day of seeing each other. Like, I can't trust that this is genuine. It might just be another way to try to get into each other's pants. Like Joey's emotional magic story you tell when you want to have sex in Friends. Ariadne tells Theseus she can't help him defeat the Minotaur, and she runs off to comfort her brother, who seems to have these earthquake-causing tantrums at exactly the right moments. Icarus manages to recut the video of them in the room into something sexy enough to keep Ariadne out of trouble, I guess. And then it's the first night of the games. All the competitors chose random numbers to see which order they would go in to face the Minotaur, and Theseus is going to go last. He thinks it's been arranged this way. Ariadne's like, that's impossible, it's totally random, and I just don't know how she could be so stupid as to honestly believe that. This is a good time to call spoilers, so if you do plan on reading Lifestyles of Gods and Monsters, be warned. Going ahead, we are in heavy spoiler territory. So the first contestant goes into the maze, and he just gets obliterated. Ariadne watches it for the first time because Theseus makes her. Normally, she just runs right back to her room and starts playing video games, but Theseus makes her sit there and watch it live so that she can really see what's going on. So now, faced with this, she really needs to make a choice on what to do. And she goes to see her brother after all this is over to kind of take care of him and, you know, hopefully help her decision. And conveniently, he signs to tell her that he's all done. So already you can see how this book will end. You know, you have to make a hard choice between the life of the dude you're in hormone with or the tortured brother whose humanity only you can see. Let's make it easy by just making brother want to die. Everybody wins. Theseus decides that he's going into the maze next to end all of this and convinces all the other competitors that this was rigged, and so they let him go in out of turn. When the time comes for Ariadne to lead the next competitor down to the labyrinth during the show, she and Theseus go in together instead, because remember, she's got the string and she's the only one who can navigate the maze, just like in the original myth. But oh no! Her string has been taken offline, so now she can't navigate the maze. She knows the direction, but she needs Theseus to help her get through the booby traps that are still working. Theseus catches me before I step forward into a tar pit. An obstacle? We were not looking for any obstacles because my thread disarms them. Icarus, I say, why are there obstacles? I don't know, Icarus says, and I can hear the sound of typing as he's searching his systems. Oh, Hades, Ariadne, his voice returns. They've disabled your thread. The obstacles are online. I rack my brain, thinking about the obstacles, forcing myself to remember what is down there. I've been involved in planning sessions, but I wasn't really paying attention. It never occurred to me that my thread wouldn't work when we went in the maze. I've never done any obstacles, I say. We'll be fine, Theseus says. obstacles are good. They'll keep us on our toes. Like, this would have been fine if Ariadne knew how to get past all these traps, or even at least had a concept of it, but she doesn't. Theseus has to do it all. So the one thing that Ariadne did in the myth, she doesn't even get to do that here. Which, the first second she has to do something that doesn't involve making out with him. No, we gotta let the prince do the hard labor. Okay, yeah, whatever. I mean, I don't know. To be fair, I might just be butthurt because I wanted it to be a little bit more mythologically accurate, but whatever. I just think it's dumb that she had this ball of wire the whole time, and then at the very end, she doesn't even get to use it. She keeps talking about this thing as the reminder of her responsibilities, and blah, 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 blah. She's never been without this string. Oh my gosh, that string. And then she can't even use it at the very end. Sure. Okay. Whatever. It's fine. We're fine. This is fine. They make it to the middle of the maze, and the Minotaur allows Theseus to defeat him by snapping his neck while Ariadne's watching. He then turns back into a full human before magically disappearing. Theseus has won. And this scene is like, I don't know how to feel about it, because on one hand, like, Ariadne is very emotional seeing her brother dying and whatever, but on the other hand, I feel like Theseus could have just like stabbed him or something quicker, but no, he like gets up on him and snaps his neck, and he doesn't even die instantly. Like, he turns back into a human and is able to say Ariadne's name before finally dying. So I don't know how I would feel about it if a boyfriend of mine snapped my brother's neck, even if I thought my brother wanted it. It's just a little, yeah, Sigmund Freud would be a fan of this. Now, because Theseus has won, the contest is over. No more Minotaur. Theseus gets to go home. And because Ariadne will be screwed if she stays in Crete after she helped him, and because she won't get to be screwed in a very different way if Theseus leaves, Ariadne decides to go back with him to Athens. Eh, happy ending, blah, 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 right? No. With less than 50 pages to go, Ariadne and Theseus have a serious discussion about what it would mean for them to stay together, and they agree that it would basically be declaring war between their two countries. Ariadne says she won't come with him to Athens. She'll stop off at a little island so that her family won't be able to find her, but they also won't be able to start a war with Athens for stealing her. The captain of the ship comes down and helps her disguise herself, and Ariadne is ready to go. The captain holds the scissors to the nape of my neck, and they make a sawing sound through my thick braid. Finally, she cuts it loose, and my head feels light on my shoulders. The captain hands me my 2-foot-long braid, and I look at it while she continues trimming my hair. "What do I do with it?" I ask. Theseus looks like a fish that has been pulled out of the water. He is actually making gasping sounds. "Theseus," I say, "you're freaking me out now. It's going to be okay." "This is necessary," the captain says sternly. "You are a king now. Kings make sacrifices." "Yes," Theseus says, taking my braid out of my hands. "I'll just hold on to this." He'll just hold on to that, to your braid that was cut off of your head. What is he going to do? Actually, no, I take it back. I don't want to know what he's going to be doing with this 2-foot-long braid of random hair. Oh, okay, moving on. Theseus goes out, is welcomed by his people as the new king of Athens, and Ariadne is taken away somewhere else. And now on her own, she meets new friends all of a sudden, gets a job, and basically has a day where she experiences what it is to be her own person without the expectations of her family, of fame, or Theseus. I take off my shoes and walk down to the silent beach. My footprints are the only marks in the sand. Is this what a bird feels like the first time it flies? This is what I dreamed of. This is freedom. The waves roll in and out, tickling my toes. I put my hand in my pocket, touching the blue blanket and the ball of silver thread. I think of my brother, the peaceful look in his eyes as he lay on the floor of the maze, his hands healed from their scars. He gave up his life so that I could be free, free to be my own person, to find my own life. And I did. That is the last paragraph of the book. So, it done. Wasn't that plot amazing? Don't worry, we'll get right into the review. I won't string you along with my crappy myth puns. It took me a few days to accurately decide how I feel about this book. We get introduced to Theseus on page 13. So that is a lot of hormonal neck-nuzzling and hip-hugging and whatever the hell else these two do to have to get through. The first half of the book is really irritating and annoying because, just like Tierney in The Grace here, Ariadne hates her world but doesn't even have the desire to try to make a difference. She says she's concerned about her brother, but she ultimately, does she attempt to better his situation? No. She gives the gods every morning a piece of toast along with the prayer, please heal my brother. But even that is just toast. Toast. You're a princess. You're rich. Give, at least even if it doesn't work, give something of value to you so that I can believe that you really want this prayer to be answered. Instead, you're like, I care about my brother so much. I give the gods a scrap of toast. Oh, please heal my brother. No, no, I know that you don't care. She has to play video games instead, as she has been for literally always until Theseus shows up. And just like always, it's for him that she will move herself into action. It's for him that she will develop and become the woman she is meant to be. Without Theseus, none of this would have happened. She would still be sitting there playing video games and bitching. Once she does start developing, we do get some really interesting issues brought up here. Like, can you judge other women based on how they dress? And have you ever put yourself in their shoes to maybe see why they're behaving so wildly? Also, it looks at the way that women are forced to sexualize themselves, or at least are expected to sexualize themselves as they grow older, and how that changes the world's perception of them. But, like, at the same time that all this is going on, she's talking about issues, and then she goes right back and is, like, kissing Theseus, and it's so icky because they started kissing before they even knew anything about each other. So I don't care about the issues, even though they're being brought up. Well, so much of this was just hormones, and I'm sick of that. So this all was a good inclusion, but it was too late in the game. Why didn't we have these issues brought up right away? Right away, even if Ariadne is saying, like, I'm too scared to do anything about it, but I know that they are there. No, Ariadne's just in a dumb world by herself, and the only reason that she wakes up is because of freaking Theseus. So, good inclusion, but too late in the game. I would have loved this book if Ariadne, same exact situation going on, but if Ariadne had already been looking actively for a way to end the contest, or even just thinking, like, maybe this contest is unethical. Maybe I should be doing something about it, but I don't know what to do. And then if Theseus comes along and reveals that he also wants to do that, maybe they could make a plan, like, and team up to do it together. Then at the same time, it would be interesting if she is being forced to take it sexual with him when maybe she doesn't want that because they're just friends. Or maybe even if she does want it, it's moving too fast for her. Then at the end, if they were, you know, friends, or maybe someday they might be something, that would explain why they would go their separate ways. You know, not as separated lovers, but as close friends who accomplished what no one else could do by being true to what they knew was right. as it stands, I ended up giving this book a 3.5 out of 5 star rating. I like that Ariadne did finally develop, and I like that she was able to find happiness just on her own, you know, not in the arms of a rugged bad boy. But we should have been building up to that from the beginning, instead of being thrown into this weird world where Ariadne is just, you know, making out with Theseus for literally no reason all the time. You cannot ask me to emotionally invest in a character who cares about nothing except for getting her groove on with the bad boy who smells like mint. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Great YA Quest, as we reviewed Lifestyles of Gods and Monsters by Emily Robertson. I just made this podcast public last month, and you guys have been really awesome. Like, honestly, I didn't expect that anyone would listen to it, but so many of you have, which is really cool. Please share it with anyone who is also a reader, or maybe who's also just grumpy, you know, likes to make fun of teenagers. Let's rant together. If you read this book, please let me know what you thought of my rating. Was I too generous or was I too harsh? Did I completely miss the point? Is there another YA book that you think I should look into? Let me know on my Instagram at ReneeMPTCray. We will also occasionally have polls where I'll ask you what book we should be reading next, so make sure to keep an eye on that and you will be able to kind of know what's coming up. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you will join me again next month when we continue The Great YA Quest.